Episode 3 of Season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geek Speak. This week's episode's a little different. I went ahead and visited Dawn Motika at her doctor's office in Santa Cruz, and we ended up chatting for like an hour and a half about how the human body works, mostly focused around digestion. I had a lot of fun chatting with her, and I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hi, it's great to be here. This will be fun.
Please define functional medicine, because this is your primary role as a physician, yes?
Functional medicine. Well, currently, it is absolutely my role, although I spent 25 years being a primary care doctor, and the knowledge base of the two are identical, but it's more like the analogy of the three men and the elephant. If you're at the front end, it looks like a python. If you're at the back end, it looks like a mule. And what we do is take that same elephant, which is to say the human body and its physiology and its biochemistry, and we approach it with a different framework. So you could think of functional medicine as a systems approach, where systems is defined by the interaction and the feedback loops between the various organs and hierarchies. So hormones, neurotransmitters, the functions of cellular defense, is a function. Assimilation is a function, and assimilation occurs at your lungs through the assimilation of oxygen, your digestive tract through the assimilation of whatever food you put in your mouth, and also at the cellular level, at the uptake of those compounds that are floating around in the bloodstream. So all of those would be assimilation functions. In distinction, conventional medicine or allopathic medicine will look at the disease and the organs. So you have the diseases of the lung, like asthma is a disease of the lung, and rheumatoid arthritis is a disease of the joints, whereas in functional medicine, those would both be problems with the defense mechanisms, an inappropriate or aberrant functioning of the system of defense. In the case of the asthma, often allergies or neurotransmitters, epinephrine, which is technically a hormone in the circulatory system, and a neurotransmitter is norepinephrine in the brain. So that is malfunctioning and causing airway contraction. So the asthma is a normal function that's gone awry. And in the case of rheumatoid arthritis, that's an autoimmune disease, where the cellular functioning that should be protecting you from bacteria has now gone awry, basically a programming error, and is now attacking self.
But this sounds to me, it just sounds like medicine. So why do you have to have a declared separation? What is it going wrong in the medical field not to understand this more complex systems?
Silos of knowledge. So doctors, conventional doctors, are trained to think in terms of their silo. So when I family practice, don't for that matter, but we've been squeezed out of the hospitals and essentially relegated to the role of triage specialist. Our job is to figure out what specialist to send the patient to.
So then you'd send them to a lung specialist because
of asthma.
Oh, you have
a lung problem. I will send you to a lung specialist.
And then, of course, they'll diagnose some kind of medicine that will be a hormone that will cause the airways to slightly open up, not actually addressing the real problem that was the reason why that occurred in the first place.
Sure. And okay, so, for example, in functional medicine, you go upstream, and in conventional medicine, you go downstream. So you go to the end organ, and you go to the ultimate thing that's going wrong, and you figure out a way to block it.
So it seems to me that one of the side effects of having a practice like yourself is that you're going to receive patients that have already had a lot of failure in the medical system.
Yes.
Does that mean that you run into patients that have, I mean, just in general, more challenging? And I don't just mean from their disease, but also from their personality type, where they've already gotten to the point where they're frustrated and upset and have been dealing with pain for years. Is that a regular patient for you?
Yes, but I think that the way it actually works is quite the opposite of what you're thinking. Because in general, when patients come to see me, it's the first time in years that anyone's listened to them.
Right.
Because instead of
so
sitting there,
relief.
Yeah, instead of sitting there concentrating on, okay, what category does that belong to? What pigeonhole do I put that? What pigeonhole do I put that? How can I come up with one drug that will maybe treat two or three of those pigeonholes, if I'm lucky? People find that the doctor is making eye contact and actually listening to them and asking questions that show that they are actually listening, mm-hmm. plus letting the patient talk, which almost never happens in a conventional medicine visit anymore. And it brings people to tears. I mean, I have patients who, as they're signing their check, because it's a cash practice, as they're giving me money, they're like shaking my hand and thanking me for listening to them and allowing them to tell their story mm-hmm. instead of trying to edit their story or spin their story to fit into my pigeonholes.
Are you having success? I mean, in the sense that are people getting healthier visiting you?
Yes. Okay. And furthermore, the patients are having success at changing the things that are the root of their problem rather than just accumulating a list of drugs to block the end. Right. Of the problem.
And I'm assuming the root of the problem are things, mostly diet.
Not only diet, although poor nutrition is responsible for a great many of the chronic diseases that we confront, or overnutrition, excess of calories, but an absence of micronutrients would be the simplest way to describe what plagues a lot of people.
Yeah.
But the other things that we find are often we find genetic variations that make a very big difference in how a person's going to respond to their nutrition. Often we'll find an extraordinary sensitivity because of the way this person breaks down compounds. Chronic fatigue and chemical sensitivity syndrome are examples of things that are not acknowledged really as medical mm-hmm. diseases because they don't fit into any of those pigeonhole categories. So they just fall off.
There's no specialist to send them to.
There's no specialist to send them to. And because these are complicated multifactorial problems, they're very difficult to work with a reductionist mentality. You need a synthetic systems-based mentality. You know, think about when you're flowcharting a program or something like that. Let's suppose you have a complex function. Mm-hmm. You're taking the top view. You have all of these things it has to do, but you need to see how all of these subroutines fit together into a larger whole and how you feed the inputs from one subroutine that has an output. That output is an input for the next routine. And if you don't get those things in the right order,
it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
Of course, in a software place, an analogy from that perspective, all those pieces are extremely well known, even though the system gets very complex, so much so that we get out of the bounds of the human ability to comprehend it. Individually, those pieces are completely well known, right? We engineered those things. We know exactly how they work. So in medicine, though, the boundaries of everything you've mentioned are right at the boundary of our knowledge, right? If they became as they become more and more aware, as we understand more about genetics, as we understand about everything you've mentioned, actually, we will get better and better at this. But at the point right now, there's this giant unknown at the outskirts of all these things. So you have to be excessively aware at the research boundary, right? I mean, you have to be basically on top of all the research.
That's true. And that's one of the reasons that I've had fodder for my radio program and now podcast for all of these years. I wanted to say, though, that as I've been listening to your program and also reading about machine learning and the genome-wide association studies and things like that, we've gotten to the point where the software engineers don't, in fact, know how the machines are doing what they're doing anymore.
No, that's very true. Neural nets, we don't comprehend the inner pieces, but actually every node we understand. You know,
Set it up, and then you stand back and you let it happen.
Yes.
And so you know how to set it up.
Yes.
But how it actually does it itself and what exactly it's doing and whether, in fact, I understand now we're running into problems with trying to use it, for example, for insurance adjusters and for deciding whether or not you should underwrite someone, and they throw all these factors in.
Right.
But then someone is getting denied and it's not clear whether or not it's a valid reason.
Absolutely. The idea, and I've been on this idea for quite a while on GeekSpeak, that this idea that the systems do get complicated enough. And even systems that are not designed with neural nets in mind or other machine learning technologies, they still become complicated enough for a person not to understand them completely, which means that what are they really, right? Most machines in our lives, somebody understands completely, right? And we know how a car works. There might be a detail about how a catalytic converter doesn't work, but in general, it's pretty well known. And there's definitely someone that definitely knows. But in our complex systems, definitely, in no way is it completely known.
And they don't always function the same way.
True.
What I would point out is if you did the same setup and you ran three different neural net systems on the same data, I suspect that you would actually get some subtly different deviations in terms of the decisions that would be made by those individuated learning systems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so that's really where we're at in functional medicine, is that we understand some of the inputs, mm-hmm. and we can look at the outputs. We can measure a lot of the outputs. And we have to trust the sophistication of the physiology, that if we actually support it and figure out what the adverse inputs are and where the what I call the vortices are, the loops where people get trapped into what in chaos theory you call a strange attractor.
Mm-hmm. And or gravity well or anything
like that. Right, gravity well, that's another good analogy. The strange attractor concept we see all the time in cardiology, ventricular arrhythmias.
Tell me what it's like in cardiology. Like, how do you see it?
Well, all right. So, for example, normally the way the heart is supposed to be, you have a pacemaker, and that's in the right atrium, and it has been engineered to be the thing that responds to the bloodstream and to the nervous inputs to the heart and speed up or slow down the heartbeat, increase the force of the contractions. All of that is effectively being done as an automated system, rather like a thermostat.
Okay.
And there are characteristics to the actual action potential that's generated in that part of the heart in the refresh rate. So all of the heart muscles are neurons. That's one of the really interesting characteristics of heart muscle cells, is they're also capable of generating a neurologic action potential.
Interesting.
Self-sufficient in their ability to generate that action potential.
Okay, so normally in my arm, when my muscle moves, there's neurons that are sent down that trigger it to move, but the muscle itself, fibers don't have neurons in them.
Exactly.
So it has to be kind of controlled by an outside force.
Yes.
Like my brain.
Right.
But in the heart has a little bit different. It has neurons in the tissue itself.
And it has a series of neurons that have gradually more latency in terms of their refresh rate.
Mm-hmm.
So that the pacemaker always wins. If you shock the heart, part of what you're doing is zeroing out all of the registers in all of the cardiomyocytes at once. And so then there's time for these cells to recover their action potential capability, and the SA node recovers first.
And so, when you say the SA node, you also called that the
pacemaker.
The pacemaker, but you're not talking about an electronic pacemaker. You're talking about the built-in
pacemaker.
The
innate pacemaker.
Is that a part of the heart that has more neurons, or?
It has a specialized neuron that has a rapid refresh rate, so it recovers after an action potential more quickly. And then there is a pathway, the tract, that is a fast track to an area between the two atria and between the two ventricles. So sort of in the geometric center, the common wall that mm-hmm. all of the chambers have, that's called the AV node. And the AV node has a somewhat slower latency, but it's still much faster than all of the other cardiomyocytes.
Okay.
So it's your backup pacemaker. So the regular pacemaker paces at about 60 to 70. The AV node paces at about 45 to 55. If both of those are taken out, your heart will still beat. It'll beat at about 35 because the His Purkinje bus wiring in between the two ventricles will take over.
Wow.
And keep the blood moving, keep your heart beating. But with a heart rate of 35, you're not going to be running any marathons.
So these other the pacemaker one that's kind of overriding a little faster than all of them, does it, when it is doing its job, is everything else more of like responding to it?
Yes, it's being okay.
It's the driver.
It's the trigger.
Okay.
It pulls the trigger. So that action potential that comes off the SA node triggers an action potential progressively across the heart. And so you get the atria firing first.
That's why the heart looks like it's moving. It moves in like a wave form,
yes.
Almost. You can kind of see it pulsate right. Along. Yeah.
And I mentioned the His Purkinje bundle. Mm-hmm. So after it leaves the AV node, it actually fast tracks down to the bottom part of the heart, to the bottom tip. So the action potential of the ventricle actually starts way down there, basically as close to your feet as possible, and it goes in a spiral up the heart so that you get a ringing motion. So when you see an echo, it seems like the heart is kind of jumping around, and it's jumping because it's actually twisting because the muscle contractions twist the heart so that you wring the blood out of the ventricles.
Sure. Okay. Interesting.
Because wringing, just like
so twisting, it causes the ventricles to be
clear more thoroughly.
Smaller,
whereas if they just contract like that concentrically, you don't get as good a contraction. It's not as mechanically efficient.
The heart's amazing.
The heart is amazing.
Wow.
Amazing. And this is, at least in the sequential development, remember, embryologically, the heart actually starts as a hollow single chamber and then grows its walls.
Oh, wow.
And many heart defects, congenital heart defects, sure, are related to the fact that the walls don't fuse properly.
Right, there's holes in the walls and therefore it's not as efficient.
Right. Blood leaks from the right to the left. And just to stay geeky for you, when you're in utero, the heart is not pumping blood through the lungs.
What is it doing?
It's pumping blood up into the artery to the lungs, and then there is an actual corridor called the ductus arteriosus, and all the blood moves over into the aorta. So it leaves the
just
pulmonary
avoids the
artery.
Avoids the lungs.
It just bypasses the lung. The lung is all scrunched up. It's not inflated.
Right.
So it has a very, very high resistance. So the blood really can't move into the lung readily. So instead it goes across the ductus arteriosus, and that has to close right away at birth. If it doesn't close, then you're not going to be filling the lungs. You're not going to be perfusing the lungs properly.
Wow. And is that something that can be recoverable? Is that an infant situation where there's ability to recover it somehow? Or
well, some people, it doesn't close, and you have to go in there and tie it off. That's surgically.
So I totally understand the lungs having a high resistance because there's no the atmosphere is not there to help them have space.
Yeah, it's like one of those sponges that you buy that's all compressed,
sure,
and you won't suck up much water.
And I get that, you know, when the child's born, there's a bunch of squeezing that happens and other things that occur. But what actually causes the close of that direct to the what closes it?
Once the lungs open up, the ductus arteriosus has a prostaglandin that's been released during labor that causes it to contract, but it can't contract until the lungs open.
So the lungs kind of open, causing more pressure to be on that thing, and taking the pressure off of that
right, duct,
so
because now the flow of least resistance is through the lungs.
Are you ever just, with the complexity of a system like that, are you ever just in awe with how well evolution actually functions? I mean, it's incredible.
It is. And it's, again, if you want to think about machine learning, sort of the ultimate emergent learning is evolution, mm-hmm, and the way that these incredibly complex systems, just bacterial physiology alone, and don't get me started on the mitochondria. Actually, let's talk about the mitochondria, but not right now.
All right.
Okay. So let's stay on circulation.
Sure.
Because this is kind of fun. Hang
on just a second. Do you hear that?
It's the rain.
It's the rain. Okay, good.
We're stuck with it.
Well, the rain is something we'll just have to cope with. Okay, go on.
So remember, all of the blood to the fetus is coming in through the umbilical cord, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the blood that's going into the fetus has less oxygen than the blood. It's almost venous blood.
Really?
Yeah.
So very low blood, low oxygen
very low
counts
oxygen
going to the infant.
Right.
And that's the same blood, of course, that's going through the infant's heart.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And lungs.
Okay.
So the reason that this works at all is because the hemoglobin that infants, fetuses have in particular. Uh-huh. So while you're in utero, you make something called fetal hemoglobin. And fetal hemoglobin will release oxygen more readily. So normally, if you have an oxygen... So when you want to release more oxygen more readily to the tissues, so the fetal hemoglobin will do that, and it'll also pick up oxygen very, very avidly.
Okay.
So it'll grab it out of a low oxygen tension, whereas adult hemoglobin needs a high oxygen tension to...
When you say this hemoglobin is being produced by the placenta?
No, it's being produced by the bone marrow at
by
that point.
By the infant bone marrow.
Yes, by the bones.
Got it. Okay. So is it not circulating through the mother?
It is not circulating through the mother.
How?
Well, because the placenta is like a lung. And so the blood that is going, so what's happening is that the blood from the mother comes up against a single cell wall membrane, and these little nipples of It looks rather like the structure of the lung. If you section a placenta, it kind of looks like that. So you have all this surface area, and on one side of the surface area is the fetal circulation, and on the other side is the maternal circulation, and the blood cells come right up to each other, and the oxygen diffuses across that single membrane.
Because the child's got more oxygen.
Osmosis.
Osmosis,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Indeed. Yes. So that's actually how. What kind of things are able to go through that membrane?
Besides sugar, oxygen, salt, some drugs, small things. The placenta also has an incredibly sophisticated detoxification. Enzyme. So it's also a little bit of a liver.
I got a question for you about the detoxification. I hear that a lot in kind of woo medicine, where you need to detoxify yourself. Drink prune juice for a week and you'll detoxify.
Yeah.
What does detox, like when you said that, what does that mean?
Real detox versus new age detox?
Yes.
Okay. So real detox is the process by which things are broken down or changed by enzyme systems in the body.
Okay.
So the big detox central is the liver, but we also detoxify in our lungs, in our skin.
So when you say detoxify in this form, what you're talking about is that the liver's producing some kind of enzyme that actually molecularly transforms things.
It transforms things. So for example, let's talk about estrogen.
Okay.
That's created in the ovaries, it's also created in the adrenal gland. You have estrogen that is being made by your adrenal gland, and also as you take your testosterone and use it up and earmark it for breakdown, it's going through an estrogen phase before it's finally released from your body. Mm-hmm. And this is literally an enzyme coming along, and in the first phase, which is called phase one detoxification, a hydroxyl group, an O and an H, are grafted onto the molecule. And
this which molecule?
Any fat-soluble molecule you care to name.
Okay.
And most lipid and most water-soluble molecules start their transformation by having one of these cytochrome P450 enzymes graft on a hydroxy group. Now, sometimes that grafting on of the hydroxy group actually activates the drug, if we're talking about drugs. In the case of a hormone, that's already an active substance. When you put that hydroxy group on it, what you're doing is you're making it more reactive, because an OH group, you know, that H is not held on very tightly, and you can hook that up to a sulfur, you can hook that up to a whole bunch of other.
So effectively, that molecule can now oxate something, if you will.
Can
bond with something by dropping its hydrogen and bonding with the oxygen.
And bonding with something else, yes.
Which we call in the outside rust, right?
Yes.
In some ways.
Right. Okay. But it's also a really basic way that you prepare, that you make things lipid-soluble, water-soluble, so that they will stay in the bloodstream, stay in the bladder, and stay in the bowel, and not diffuse back across the membranes of the bladder or the intestine.
And stay in your body.
And get back into the body.
So when you say detoxification, one of the things you're saying is that this whole system is allowing it to be water-soluble, which means it can pass along in the bloodstream, but also get into the urine to get out of the body.
Right. For something to do something, it has to get out of the bloodstream, unless it's going to act in the bloodstream. So it has to be able to get across the cell wall.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that by being actively transported. So, for example, amino acids in the intestine are actively transported. You actually spend ATP to move that amino acid
into
the cell.
And ATP, of course, is the energy of the cell.
Right. Gas. It's your gas. It's all. Everything eventually turns into ATP or gets used up.
And when you say your gas, you mean your energy system of the body.
Yes, like gasoline. Right. But also the battery. You could think of it as...
Right, the electrical system, the power system.
As a battery or a spring. You can think of it as kinetic energy. All three of these metaphors work.
Of course, it is chemical energy that your cell uses. And so what you're saying is, in this situation, the cell has to use that to do what?
In the case of if you're going to absorb that amino acid from your lumen of your gut, because remember, the inside of your intestine is technically the outside of your body.
Okay.
Topologically, you are a big tube.
A big donut.
You're a big donut. Very, very bumpy donut.
Yeah.
But anyway, on the inside of that donut hole, that's where the amino acids are. You want them in your bloodstream. You have to go in and grab them.
And when you say the amino acids, you're talking about the food.
Well, amino acids in particular, glucose is also actively transported in the stomach. And there are many, many different mechanisms. But lipids don't have to be transported at all. All you have to do to absorb fat is make it small enough, and then it will literally soak into the cells of the intestine.
Okay.
And so the main thing with fat is just breaking it up to small enough little bubbles.
What causes it to break up?
Enzymes.
Okay. I feel like we've backed up a little bit. So just to be clear, when you talk about detoxification in the medical sense of the word, rather than the woo sense.
Two phases.
Okay. One of them is to attach to this to break it up, make it small enough, and potentially make it go into a water-soluble state.
Right. So
that's one stage.
Let's start with the first stage is you've got to take something that's lipid-soluble and make it water-soluble and reactive so that you can change it. So that phase goes on in the liver primarily. And that's the one that is fueled by these cytochrome enzymes, which are stimulated by fruits and vegetables, the biological compounds that are found in fruits and vegetables will trigger the liver to, basically make more of these enzymes. So you turn on the DNA, make messenger RNA, make more enzymes.
In the liver.
As a response to fruits and vegetables.
So that flows into the blood system from the liver?
Yes.
Okay.
But also the liver it makes more of them in the liver cells. Because when you eat something, everything goes through the liver. 95% of it passes through the liver first.
Okay.
And the liver gets the first pass on whether or not to transform it or let it in, untransformed. And so the first level of detoxification is also protection.
But it's moving from the digestive system to the liver.
Directly.
Through the blood or directly?
There's something called the portal system. So there's a separate blood system.
Oh.
So things don't get into the general circulation from the stomach or the intestines. They go directly to the liver through the portal circulation. The liver looks at them, inspects them, detoxifies what it needs to detoxify,
gets triggered, dumps
that into the vena cava, and then it goes up into the vena cava and dumps into the heart and gets out into general circulation.
So you get triggered, you eat your vegetables and fruits, the chemicals in that are broken down at some level in the digestive tract, pulled into the system that the liver gets a sense of them, then the liver goes, oh, it's time to make this stuff that I need to make because I've been triggered that way. Makes a whole bunch of enzymes that can then break it down further and activate some of it, detox, some of it doesn't want transform it in one way and stuff it wants transform it in another way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now the second phase of detoxification is making it so it can leave the body. So now you've made it water soluble, but you have to have some kind of, let's call it a weight. You have to get it to be stable. So it's going to stay in the urine or it's going to stay in the bowel.
Because if you don't do that, it would just float back out of the urine back into the blood system somewhere.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you put a jump ring on it and then you put a weight on the jump ring.
Who does that?
That's also the liver.
Liver's a busy
bee. Liver's a busy little bee, yeah. Right. And that's why liver transplants were an amazing breakthrough because that's really when your liver is shot, your own body compounds are poisonous to you. You literally cannot recycle
anything. Because, of course, we're talking about all the stuff that you're consuming, but also all your cells are dying every day, and that all has to be cleaned up by the liver as well. So you poison yourself by just living without the liver's help. The liver goes, okay, this is one of those things I want to go stay in the a water system, which is basically that I want the kidney to put it into the to the bladder for me. So it puts a very large molecule on it,
right?
Which basically changes its mass structure so that when it flows, what does the kidney do with that large, how does it do its job?
It's still a very small molecule.
Well, of course, but we're talking comparative to things that we don't want to get rid of.
Well, in the case of the kidney, let's use the liver. Let's use the bowel first.
Sure,
because the bowel's easier.
All right.
So in the case of the bowel, you're adding various compounds, usually sulfate or acetate, and these are large enough molecules that they and very, very water soluble. So they will, as long as it's attached to that sulfate group, it's not going anywhere. It's leaving the body.
Okay.
So you have sulfur, you have acetate, you have glucuronidate, you have a couple of other things.
Does the liver put that stuff on and then inject it to the heart? Or does the liver put that stuff on and then put it to the bowel somehow?
Puts it in the bowel and it goes in through the bile. So your gallbladder and your bile are actually transmitting a lot of these detoxified compounds.
Back into your digestive system.
Back into your digestive system in a new form. So
that won't leave.
That won't leave. Right.
Chemistry. Amazing stuff, isn't it?
Oh, and then you get into the microbiome, which is very important for detoxification because not only is it a transformative, it has its own transformative properties. But if you have certain bacteria that are considered adverse in functional medicine cycles, you will actually break that bond.
The large sulfate bond, right. Releasing this thing back in your system again. Right.
So there is an enzyme that's produced by a lot of fungi and also bacteria called glucuronidase, which breaks up one of these major detoxification moieties.
And that basically means that it's going to then go back to the liver again.
Yeah.
And the liver has to do it again.
Well, it's going to go back to the liver eventually, but meanwhile, it's going to bounce around the bloodstream.
Who knows what it's going to do?
Well, it's going to go to your breast and give you breast cancer, whatever.
Right. So the trick of this is that, so that's why like a fungal infection in your bacterial system is such a bad thing. It's going to do something that makes your system fight more effectively.
One of the chief basic things you do when you're a functional medicine doctor is you kind of take vital signs on the digestive tract and you look for symptoms that suggest that there are the wrong bacteria or that there's too many of the right bacteria in the wrong place. And these have very characteristic manifestations that...
What kind of thing?
Well, like, for example, bloating after eating is a big one. So if a person half an hour after eating, their belly bloats and they're kind of belching and they've got an uncomfortable full feeling.
What does that sound like to you?
Well, that sounds like to me, depending on the timing, like there's either too many bacteria in the upper small intestine or even in the stomach, which is called small intestine bacterial overgrowth, mm-hmm. SIBO, mm-hmm. or it suggests an absence of hydrochloric acid so that the person is not able to empty their stomach. So their stomach fluid is flooding into the stomach and you're continually churning, trying to digest.
It's never leaving.
But it's not leaving because you can't get the pH low enough to trigger the exit of the food because that's pH dependent.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So there's... Because the stomach's like a washing machine. Yeah. So then you have the rinse cycle. And if you can't trigger the rinse cycle, then you just stay on the wash cycle forever.
Right. And then, of course, anything that's growing in there that can handle that environment does really well. It never gets cleared. It never moves through your system. So if you've got the bloating, one of those things is happening. And all of those things mean we've got to get that system flowing still. Mm-hmm. So, okay, back to the detoxification. When I first mentioned the woo aspects, detoxification, you were like, oh yeah.
Yeah, well, blackstrap molasses and apple cider vinegar and...
These diabetes that are supposed to help you somehow.
Right.
But, okay, so...
Or fasting. And let's talk about fasting. Sure, go ahead and finish your question.
Yeah, the comment really was, when a terminology that's extremely specific gets used in a broad sense like that, it diminishes the terminology. It confuses the situation, right? Because now if I were to do research on detoxification, there'd be no way for me to know what was woo and what was not. Because, of course, though I'm totally understanding what you're saying, I'm not taking all those words and adding them to my vocabulary, mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to be able to go back and look this up. So there is a large level of education necessary to separate those two terms.
Definitely.
What about moving away from the term detoxification and moving to a different term? Or is that just not helpful because it is what the meaning is?
Well, I like to use the substitute word biotransformation.
So that sounds good too.
Because that is absolutely accurate. Mm-hmm. And it gets away from the toxin word. And again, certain words take on a cultural significance sure. that's hard to shake.
Yeah.
I think we could say that politically we see a lot of that where whether you call someone pro-choice or anti-abortion tells you a lot. You've already essentially prejudged mm-hmm. the
words have
the
power
setting, yeah. right? You've spun it by the first two words out of your mouth, depending on what you say there. Mm-hmm. And in the case of when you say detoxification to a traditional MD, it's kind of like when you say cancer to a layperson, they don't hear the next words out of your mouth. If you say you have cancer, the patient has just checked out. They will not hear you. When you say to a doctor, I think there's a detoxification issue here, they check out and they don't hear you.
Right.
If I say to a doctor, this patient has a problem with their cytochrome 2D6 that is genetic, and here's your data, doctor, on that. They cannot activate tamoxifen, so if you try to use tamoxifen for their breast cancer management, it will fail. So please consider another drug. And
so are you, in a lot of sense, acting in your role as a functional doctor, functional medicine doctor, are you acting as a translator for traditional medicine lots of times? I think
I'm allowed to, mm-hmm. And that has to do with the openness of the doctor, and doctors are so pressured right now, and many of them are just, blinders on in the trenches, just trying to stay afloat. They're really, really stressed, and so when I can get someone aside and I can explain it, maybe when they're in a relaxed situation, but clinically, I don't really force people to have that dialogue.
Yeah.
I generally let the results speak for themselves. So when patients who have had bone pain or muscle aches for a long time and a quote-unquote normal vitamin D level, but they have, I check their DNA and they have a vitamin D receptor mutation, so they aren't going to do well with normal herd average vitamin mm-hmm. D levels. They're going to need maybe a level of 60 or 80 to feel good. And all I do is raise their vitamin D level and all of those, and they stop going to their primary care doctor with their aches and their pains.
You solve the problem.
Because they no longer have them. Then usually with one such experience, that particular doctor will start ordering vitamin D levels and treating them in patients with diffuse achiness mm-hmm. because a couple of spectacular successes are really all it takes to change someone's mind about something. But we need, in functional medicine, to actually get to the doctors during their early socialization so that they don't get stuck in these silos. And the medical schools recognize that they are not paying attention to nutrition, but they don't actually know nutrition mm-hmm. at the medical schools because they know deficiency diseases,
right.
And they think that's nutrition.
Right.
That's not nutrition. Nutrition is not the prevention of deficiency diseases. And you could think of those deficiency diseases like beriberi or kwashiorkor or pellagra as these are such distinct deficiency states with such obvious stereotypical manifestations that we can actually recognize them the way you recognize measles
right.
or mumps, because this is this weird thing and the cheeks puff out and that's mumps, dude. And there's nothing else that does that.
Right.
And, that's not what's going on here in our population. What's going on here is low-level deficiencies that impair function, but not so much that you get these, neon sign kind of physical manifestations. You've just got somebody who doesn't feel right, who doesn't energy.
And if you look at everything that you can sense in the traditional sense, they've got their vitamin D levels are fine. Except then you say, actually they can't pick up DNA. They can't pick up vitamin D as well because of a genetic difference. And so now you're in a situation where you have to start really understanding that standard of vitamin D that everyone should have is the 90% standard.
Right.
And there's the 10% people that need less or more.
The outliers. And this is one of our catchphrases in functional medicine is that allopathic medicine does medicine on the average.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are in that 70% that's the center of the bell curve,
within
one standard deviation of the mean, you'll be fine with allopathic medicine. And the outliers are just not going to be fine. They're
right.
not going to do well, and they're going to be problem patients. And they'll develop themselves secondary psychological manifestations that will allow the physician to dismiss their core problems as manifestations of their depression. They're depressed because they've been in pain and haven't been able to sleep for 10 years.
Right.
And that's why they're depressed. They're not having pain and are unable to sleep because of the depression.
Right.
And so you run into this misattribution, chicken and egg directionality of causality problem all the time. And it's very threatening to your ego to have people who just won't get better no matter what you give them.
Right.
And those are the people that come see functional medicine doctors and many times are able to change those fundamental things that are getting in their way. And sometimes
right.
it's really hard to figure it out and it takes a lot of detective work. But it's fascinating and extremely rewarding when you do transform people's lives, because they're able to recapture the vigor or the energy that they had 20 or 30 years ago before the thing happened, whatever the thing was.
Right.
And the other problem with some of these diseases that are quote-unquote idiopathic, which means we don't understand them medically, what their cause is, a lot of those are going to turn out to be deficiency diseases or lack of a certain nutrient or a certain nutrient cofactor, but we don't have a marker for it that we can test in their bloodstream. And the ones where we do have the markers,
we solve those problems, right?
We solve those problems.
Yeah. So how different is it now to be able to do full genetic screening on people and actually get their genome? Is that changing the way you can detect? Like you mentioned that there's a genetic aberration that makes vitamin D pickup harder. And therefore, you can see that if you have someone take a $200 test that gives them a full genome screen. You can see those right off the bat.
Right.
How quickly is that changing? Like 5 years ago compared to now, are you seeing a lot of differences in what you can detect from the genome?
Actually, I think we've taken a wrong turn on the research, because they're still using this kind of one gene equals one disease. And when that didn't work out, then it's like, okay, well, we need to find the magic combination of genes that cause the disease. And we don't understand the mechanism of how any of these genes work or what to do about it. But if you've got this particular set of genetic variations, you're at increased risk. So you get these ridiculous kind of statements in 23andMe or Prometheus or whatever you're looking at. It's like, oh yeah, you have a 1.23 odds ratio for Alzheimer's, and then you've got another gene that gives you a 1.69 odds ratio, and then you've got one that gives you a 0.78, and you can't add these numbers or you can't just add them up and figure out what your probability is, because they don't combine. We don't know the combinatorials of them at all.
Yeah.
So it's not being used strategically. And so what I do is I only look at actionable DNA.
And how do you know it's actionable?
Because these are things that we have something we can do about them.
Mm-hmm.
So we can either, and mostly that's in the functional medicine world. So those are things like your detoxification SNPs. Are you fast acetylator? Are you a slow acetylator? Methylation SNPs. And methylation is this really key metabolic process where there's biotransformation to create methyl groups. And I mentioned hydroxy groups. Mm-hmm. Well, a CH3, a methyl group, those are what you use for your epigenetics. So when you change DNA, turn it on or turn it off, you do that by the expedient of putting a CH3 group literally on the DNA at a point.
Okay.
And if you don't have enough methyl groups available because you have a mutation in one of your basic methylation enzyme processes,
Then
you can't trigger that gene, or you can't untrigger that gene. So if you've got you can't silence genes. And essentially,
what's a
cancer
gene that you'd want to silence?
Oh, well, let's see. mTOR or P.
What's mTOR? Let's just
mTOR is the something target of rapamycin, and it's a weird name. But what mTOR is it's a major growth controller. And it allows cells to, if I remember correctly, it has an effect on cellular adhesion. So if you wake up mTOR, cells don't stick together and they can migrate off and go do their own thing, which is what we call cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there are also many genes that are involved in rapid growth that are turned on during embryologic growth, but have to be turned off during adulthood. And if they get turned on, particularly if they get turned on in a stem cell line, you've got what you call a cancer.
Mm-hmm. A self-replicating, never stops kind of greedy thing.
The sorcerer's apprentice, right? With the broomstick that keeps.
And so you're saying that can actually be caused because you're not making enough of these methyl groups to control.
Absolutely.
But when you say you don't make enough of those methyl groups, there's a gene that I've got to turn off that caused rapid growth for infancy and through larger growths in our life. And now I need to turn it off. Does every cell have to be turned off every time we split? I mean, how often does this have to occur?
Well, this is where you take a step back and realize that not adult somatic cells don't split like bacteria. We think of it that way, but actually there's a specific clone of cells in all of our body tissues called stem cells, and those are the only cells that get to divide.
Okay.
The adult cells don't divide. They are terminally differentiated, and they don't undergo mitosis. The mitosis is happening in a specialized tissue that needs to be strictly controlled so that it doesn't go crazy.
So when that tissue decides, okay, I need a new bone cell or something, and it starts to produce a new bone cell, it has to make sure to control it, as that cell is being created out of the stem cell, it has to be set up to be that bone cell. And that process, if it's not done correctly, abnormations, problems.
Right.
Okay.
And so methylation silences genes. If you don't silence genes properly, then you've already got inappropriate functionality for your role.
Right.
And that you get too much inappropriate functionality, then you've got essentially a freed, I don't know if this happens with machines. In software where a program will sort of go rogue on you and start doing something else. But that's effectively what's happening in a cancer cell.
Well, you're talking about a machine that just goes off. And of course, most of the time that going off is probably going to be terminal for the cell. I mean, in the sense that I'm assuming that a lot of times you make something function poorly in a cell and the cell is just not going to do anything. Maybe it won't even get ATP effectively, and it's just, then it gets cleaned up by the liver. Interesting. So let's see. So you're saying that I'm assuming it's beneficial to have these genetic tests. At the same time, there's all this kind of cruft around them that doesn't give you a lot.
And that's why the FDA pulled 23andMe's ability to analyze it, or at least present that information, which didn't do anything. It just created a whole bunch of secondary operators that process the info, and they can't be, because this is, First Amendment rights, this is free speech, they can't be regulated by the FDA at all.
Right. And people are using for medical purposes, and they really shouldn't. Effectively,
well, people are also freaking themselves out and drawing the wrong conclusions about this data a lot of the time.
So this stuff is really immature and shouldn't be based on it. I mean, I found some fun stuff. I had a friend recently that did a genetic test and got the 23andMe thing, and we looked through it. And I didn't know that the smell of asparagus in your urine is a gene that you can have or not have. In fact, Miles, who you know very well, is on the show all the time with me. He can't smell that. And I had no idea. So that's the kind of fun, if you're related to Genghis Khan. Like, there's some fun aspects to these, to these things. But also, I'm assuming there are some very beneficial things. When you know there's a marker that does mean, there's an 80% chance here that there's a deficiency in the uptake of vitamin D,
so let me
then
give
it's
you,
really useful, right?
Yeah, let me give you a really useful one.
Sure.
Methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. Now, when you have an A's on the end of it, that means it's an enzyme. And what this does is it takes folic acid and it transforms it.
Where does folic acid come from?
It comes from food, fruits and vegetables. And also we know that if you don't have enough folic acid while you have a pregnancy, that there's an increased risk of birth defects. Because if you don't have enough folic acid, you don't have enough methyl groups to turn on and off the DNA in the fetus.
And so that acid gets transformed. And when you have this problem in your genome, you don't do it as well.
That's right. And what that does is it creates, if you think about the intermeshed fashion of the output from one system becomes the input for the next, if you have a slow production of the output because a particular computer in your system is sluggish. It has a virus. It's got some sort of problem. And so it's not producing its output. Well, that's the weak link and everything else slows down.
Yeah.
So the same exact thing is going on with methylation. So if you can't do that folate transformation to methylfolate, you can't donate that methyl group to methionine, and then you can't go move forward into homocysteine, and then you can't send that methyl group off to S-adenosylmethionine, which is SAMe, which goes off and creates neurotransmitters. So people who have this particular mutation have higher risks of, get this, depression, bipolar disorder, cancer of all kinds, and heart disease. because one of the intermediates that builds up in this flawed system is something called homocysteine, which is directly toxic to the inside of your arteries.
And of course, that is part of the overflow because the system's not doing this transformation mm-hmm. well.
Exactly.
What do you do in that situation?
Well, right at the moment, since we can't fix the enzyme, CRISPR not having gotten up to the point where we can use that, well, get back to me in 15 or 20 years. But right now what we do is we supply the intermediate metabolite. So we give methylated folate that's pre-methylated. So we leapfrog over the slow step.
So you do you inject that?
No, we can give it orally.
Okay.
It'll absorb orally.
And so then all of a sudden you're producing the thing, the enzyme, the genome doesn't do it effectively. And now you're in a situation where your system can flow relatively
right.
well.
Right. So the speeds of the secondary systems that were waiting for that methylated folate, they speed back up to normal speed.
So does that mean that you run to a patient, they say, I'm depressed, I had some heart problems, and I had trouble with pregnancy and actually had birth defect and was never able to conceive and...
Like a woman who's had multiple miscarriages, yeah. I would check her for that. Particularly,
so you check her for that by just like having her get one of these genome tests. Then you look at it and go, oh, look at that marker's there. Mm-hmm. And then you give her a supplement that she eats forever, and she all those symptoms go away.
Yeah,
assuming
that that was the right. sole source of the symptoms.
Of course, there
could
have been something else as well. Yeah,
but yes, it is just that easy or just that difficult, depending.
So when you're in that situation, that clear transformation is going to go back into the standard medical practice at this point, right? Because it's such an obvious example of success, I'm assuming, right? Is that happening?
No.
Why not?
Good question.
Because of the education system and the siloed and the stressed out doctors.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. And I just want to emphasize that I'm not trying to blame the allopathic physicians.
No.
They are in a really adverse, at least in this country, they're in a really adverse situation.
They're fighting with the hospitals and they're fighting with the insurance companies.
Yes. Yeah. They're spending, and the advent of computers has, it was so promising, but the implementation in this country has been abysmal. And as a result,
in what way? How has it negatively impacted medicine?
Well, let's take Finland, for example. Little country. They do some of the best research in epidemiology there is. And that's because they have everybody on the same computer system. All the doctors are using the same computer system. All the patients from cradle to grave. Their data goes through this computer system. So if you want a report on how many Finns used Prozac in 1983,
you know, and
you also know whether or not they took it.
Right.
Because you have the refill data. And
that's
if people
amazing.
Aren't taking their meds, they generally don't refill them. So we have nothing. We have nothing.
And this is because of privacy concerns or what? Why is it because of commercialism in this system?
Well, I would say that the core problem was the United States Congress in the early 90s, and this was when they were writing the privacy laws. Mm-hmm. They are, of course, very influenced by industry, and industry had a strong vested interest in being Apple and not Google, right? You want a vertical monopoly. You want closed source. Mm-hmm. You want to control your inputs and your outputs, and you don't want to play well with others because that's not how you make a profit.
It's not how you make a monopoly.
And so everybody had the dream that they were going to be the one that had the medical record that everyone in the United States would use. And so what they created was a cacophonous mess of systems that were designed not to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so... that is the result of not having this designed by people who actually knew what they were doing, and instead making it something that people who were non-scientists, some of them anti-science, none of them at all sophisticated with computers. Remember, we're talking early 90s. Almost no one was on the internet in the right. early 90s.
So if you had a system where everyone's medical information was in the same system, what kind of data would allow us to treat people better?
Well, like for example, we could take all of that GWAS data that we're getting from the DNA, and we could actually just data mine our population.
Right.
So we could go back, let's suppose that we did this in 1990, okay, just you know, if we did it right.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Wouldn't it be nice? But if we had done it by 1997, you know, we would have now 20 years of data that would be who got cancer, who didn't get cancer, what DNA do they have, who we'd be able to filter out the ethnicity. We wouldn't have to worry about the confounds. We'd be identifying all sorts of people with this set of detoxification mutations should never take this drug because it will kill them in 10 years. But you won't know that unless you actually can do machine level analysis of the data. It's not something that's ever going to turn up as a cluster.
Without giant studies.
Yeah. Yeah. And it could be, there could be really important things that we're doing wrong.
Right.
That we would figure out.
Quickly. Yeah.
Well, not quickly, because if it has a long latency.
We need to set it up again.
I'm suspecting that only the short latency things have ever been discovered that you can figure out in a couple of years, because suddenly you have an uptick in the number of cases of whatever. And you go, why do we have that uptick of cases of whatever? Like the microcephaly. I mean, the Zika epidemic is classic. So think about what happened here. Zika's been around. We've known about it since the 40s. It was mostly in Africa. They have a lousy public health system. Nobody ever noticed the microcephaly.
Why?
Well, either the Zika mutated recently, or they just never spotted it. Because Zika is one of a gazillion viruses running around Africa, and they don't differentiate particularly.
Someone's sick and they died.
Someone's sick and they die, and then or they get better, and then their baby is born retarded, and who notices?
And no connection because right.
Right, and so you have with Zika, you have this small, you have something you can actually see, just not mental retardation, but small little funny looking skulls, and then you have a second world system that actually went, wait a minute. We're seeing a bump in microcephaly. We have data from 10 years ago and we didn't have microcephaly. Now we've got a whole bunch of it. What's up? And then there was an outbreak of microcephaly, and they were investigating the outbreak of Zika, and they thought, "Oh, let's test these moms for evidence of Zika." And oh, wait
it's
a minute.
Same thing. Yeah.
Well, how about that? Yeah. We've got an epidemic of autism in this country. Autism rates have gone through the roof, and it's not just case finding, although that is some of it. We have no idea what it is. Something really serious is going on in our environment or in our cells. It could be a methylation change that's being transmitted over through time. We don't know what it is.
And it could be one of those things that is a affects one of the parents 20 years before they have a child kind of thing. Like, we don't know anything about it.
We do know that statistically, the older the father, the more likely you are to have autism. And we don't see that with maternal age, which is interesting.
It doesn't seem to correlate with the traditional scapegoat for this, does it?
Mm-mm.
We're not seeing any correlation with...
Oh, you know, mercury. What we see is that children who have this, whatever this genetic change is, and I'm convinced it's genetic, because they have weird stuff going on in their bodies. There are certain things about these children, particularly the ones who are very effective. And you look at it as a geneticist and you say, okay, it's multifactorial and it has variable penetrance. And
what does variable penetrance mean?
It means that you can have the DNA and manifest a bad case of it, or you can have the DNA and not manifest a bad case of it. And when you see that, that's usually an epigenetic variation.
Are there DNA markers for that seem to correlate?
There's a whole bunch, when you do these genome-wide association studies, there's a whole bunch of candidate things, but none of them are found in everyone who has it.
Right, okay.
And you get different combinations. And we don't understand at the root what exactly this disease is. We don't know what's wrong.
Right.
It's developmental. And that's...
Which is really tricky, of course, because all the development stages are all about your environment and your interactions and... Right.
Yeah, so it's real deep. It's the kind of programming that we can't look at. You know, we can't test for it yet.
You're right. So it's one of those things that if we had a lot more sample set of genomes and affected people versus non-affected people, we might be able to glean that data. I covered a story a couple weeks ago on GeekSpeak, and I'm totally forgetting the context of it, or the disease. but it could have been ALS. And it was basically that there are certain markers, and then looking at a large study and using a neural net to figure out the mappings, we were able to find like 5 markers. We used to have 3 markers for the same kind of thing. But it sounded very exciting until I started talking to you, where just because there's markers that are like a 0.4% increase or a 0.02% increase, that doesn't actually mean, that doesn't correlate to your, that's going to be a causal effect. It really could be, statistically important, but there's not a lot you can do with it at that point.
Well, yeah, the first question is that actionable? Is there something I can tell someone who has those, let's say they have 4 out of 4 markers. Mm-hmm. Is there something I can tell them advice-wise about how they can prevent this terrible disease?
No, not necessarily. Right?
So let's suppose, for example, that I knew, just taking ALS as an example, that I knew that that this is driven by a trigger, and that you're vulnerable to being triggered, and that this trigger is going to be seen at much higher frequency in people who eat a lot of fast food. So I might be able to say to that person, don't eat fast food. It raises your vulnerability to this. So for example,
That's totally valid.
Alzheimer's disease and diabetes, type 2 diabetes, which is at least semi-voluntary.
They pseudocorrelate?
Big time. So in fact, some people call Alzheimer's disease type 3 diabetes.
Oh, wow.
The same enzymatic process that breaks down beta amyloid breaks down insulin. So if you have...
What's beta amyloid?
Beta amyloid is the thing that accumulates in the neurons of people with Alzheimer's that eventually leads to nerve cell death.
Do you see more people with type 2 diabetes that then get autism?
Alzheimer's,
sorry.
Yes.
Really?
It's about a 10-year jump on the age that you get it, too.
Oh,
so you get it worse and you get it earlier. And it correlates really well with how good or bad your diabetic control is.
I don't know a lot about diabetes, but it seems to me that at some level, even without surfacing diabetes, in the sense that you're not aware you have diabetes, mm-hmm. you have insulin deficiency or insulin confusion, whatever you actually call it.
Resistance.
You can actually go through life with your body fighting all the time and dealing with sugar at a high level and stressing you and causing other issues without ever actually diagnosing that there's a problem. And we do see Alzheimer's increasing and a lot more sugar in our society. Do you feel like they're like transparently connected as much as it seems to me?
I think so. And I also think that we have a larger number of Alzheimer's people because we have a larger number of old people.
Sure.
People who would have died earlier of their heart disease.
But we started dealing with that.
We started dealing with that. And now our success basically allows for another disease to step into dominance, if you will. It's almost an evolutionary niche.
Yeah.
Something's got to kill you.
Yes.
In the case of Alzheimer's disease, it's really clear that exercise and good and low insulin levels, good glucose control, are inversely correlated with the development of the disease. And we can study this best in the human versions of this, which are the people who have all of those genes that are associated, including the double ApoE4 gene, which is associated with heart disease and Alzheimer's. And people who have 2 copies of this SNP are 10 times more likely to get Alzheimer's.
When you say SNP, you've used that before.
Nucleotide polymorphism. So go back to the genetic code, right? You have 3 nucleotides that forms a codon.
Okay.
So it's a 3-letter word.
Mm-hmm.
And that 3-letter word says arginine. So when the messenger RNA is made off that DNA and it goes to the protein factory, which is
the
ribosome, it's going to print off that instruction. So when it comes to, let's say that's GAG, when it comes to GAG, which it isn't, by the way, GAG is a start and stop signal, but whatever. So when it, let's call it CAG. So when it comes to a CAG, it's going to go, I'll pull an arginine off the shelf and plunk it right here. And then it goes one more step down, reads the next word and says, that's a glycine. So I'll grab a glycine. And the next one, that's a valine. So I'll grab a valine. So you create this string of beads of amino acids, and then they twist up and become a protein. So sickle cell anemia is a valine to leucine translation. So instead of
inversion of it.
Well, instead of being valine, instead of, let's call it valine CCA, you get a CGA. And that's enough to cause the leucine to be put in instead of the valine. So the protein folds differently. Once it's folded differently, it behaves differently.
And so when you said there was two, you could have doubles of this, meaning in both chromosomes from both parents.
Right.
And so therefore, if you only had this in one, you'd have half of your production of this protein.
Exactly.
It would be an anomaly, and you'd probably be okay at some level.
Most of the time, people who are heterozygotes, where they have one bad copy, will muddle along.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the best way to think of it.
So in this situation where there's double, though, basically that protein just does not do its function correctly, or it does it not as efficiently.
It varies.
Okay. And this is the complication of the secondary side effect, if you will, of these sites. So when you say, oh, I can see that right there, you should have had a CGC, but you have a CHC, whatever it is, then you can kind of go, okay, so something else is going to happen here.
And it also depends on what the protein does.
Right.
So if the protein's a structural protein like collagen, then even one bad copy is really bad.
How so?
Well, because if 50% of your structural components are faulty, right, you're going to run into trouble. Whereas with enzymes, you can, the functional proteins generally have feedback loops that allow you to make more of them if you aren't getting the action that you need. There's a built-in sensor that says, you know, we're just not making enough of whatever the output is. So I'm going to increase my supply of this enzyme by generating more copies of it.
And even though still half the copies are bad,
half the copies are bad, but if you step up production,
right,
then you can partially
assuming
compensate
that the rest
of
your system can take care of the extra stuff. And
mostly
break
the bad
it down.
Copies are just inert,
yeah,
and they just get trashed.
Cleaned up like
food. They aren't toxic.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, how do we get down to this track? I feel like I
well, we there. Started off with detox, and then we went into fetal circulation.
Yeah,
and we've had a real lovely my dinner with Andre.
It's been wonderful. I've really enjoyed it. I'm fascinated to hear that what I thought was such an optimistic thing of being able to see DNA and inspect it really well has not. You don't have that level of excitement because of the lack of large studies of these things, and of course because there's just a whole bunch of misinformation of what that actually means. So it's kind of sobering at that level, unfortunately.
Well, we're all victims of the way we approach a problem, right? The premises that we bring to it. And causality is very, very slippery in biology.
Yeah.
But in microbiology, causality is very straightforward. You know, you have pneumonia.
Yeah.
We have to figure out which bacteria it is so we can kill that bacteria with a drug that we know that bacteria is sensitive to. So causality is just really clear. Now, in reality, that's not true.
Yeah.
But that's how they think about it. And you get such spectacular successes that you get emotionally bonded to that set of basic premises. But let me flip it on its head. If you go into any setting, a schoolroom, a nursing home, any kind of group, dormitory, any kind of group setting, there will be individuals who will not get the pneumonia or who will not get the disease, even though they're exposed. And many times these are individuals whose adaptive systems are better. They've got a better immune system, so they're able to fight it off. Mm-hmm. They've got higher levels of lymphocytes in the mucous membranes of the nose. So they've got more mucus in their nose, so they don't get, the virus doesn't get contact with the target tissue. So there's all these host factors.
Right.
And in functional medicine, we kind of approach a disease and we say, what are the host factors and what can I do to improve those host factors? So with detox, that's where getting back to the closing our loop here on our discussion, then some of those new agey things are very legitimate. I mean, wheatgrass shakes and lots of spirulina and green drinks do benefit the individual because sometimes they will chelate heavy metals. Sometimes they will upregulate the liver's ability to detoxify.
Well, if you're someone who never eats like fresh vegetables, and all of a sudden you're drinking these things that have all these vegetables, then you're getting the stuff your body actually needs, right?
Plus, if you're eating a crap diet, there's a lot of work that your liver has to do to detoxify the crap.
Or just get rid of all that extra junk.
So it's busy doing that, and that's top priority. So imagine that your inbox just gets getting fuller and fuller and fuller, and you never can get to the bottom of the inbox. So all these sort of low-level things that should be flushed out of the body aren't being flushed out of the body.
Yeah.
And they aren't, it isn't a disease.
Right. It's just not a functioning system.
Right. It's just not a well-functioning system, hence the term.
So the term in software, when you have two systems talk to each other and they have a different rate of communication, is called back pressure. And the effect is that, you know, one system's not ready for the message and the other one's going to send the message. And so the other one is just continually trying to push the message forward.
Right.
And there's a back pressure in the system. So then the sending system backs up. And that was what we were talking about earlier. I just didn't give you the computer terminology.
No, it's excellent, though, because you can see how there's kind of a fractal nature to systems.
How so?
There are certain types of feedback loops. The systems are all about feedback loops. And this is a classic example of a broken, effectively a broken function.
Right.
So you can't handle the rate that things are coming at you, so the thing backs up.
Right.
Well, that happens at all sorts of system levels. It happens in hydrology when you flood. If you have a problem with your outflow, then you flood.
Right.
You know, the Mississippi River overflows its banks because there's just too much water coming down.
Right.
And you also get that kind of flooding phenomenon in biological systems. If you have the classic thing that we have in biology is the predator-prey relationships, right? And if you get too many predators, you collapse the food chain, mm-hmm. and then you collapse, and then the predator chain collapses right after that. So you see these things occurring in large systems. You see them occurring at the micro level. You see them occurring at the digital world.
Sure.
Because there's just only so many different ways that complex systems can exist and interact with themselves. Mm-hmm. And there's so when I say fractal, I'm using the sense that at the small scale and the large scale, you have the same thing going on, the same right. simple equations, the yeah. same simple kinds of feedback loops.
A great example of that, there's no predators, and so the prey get really large in their dominance, and then a virus comes through and kills a whole bunch of them, because, of course, their systems are all weakened by the mass scale, and therefore they start to starve, and therefore...
Collapse their own food chain right. by overgrazing.
Right. So you have this amazing kind of like multiple levels of this thing occurring over and over again, hence the fractal pattern. That's cool. I like that idea.
So in all of these systems, if you start looking at biology from a systems perspective, it's transformative for a physician. And one of the things I've been doing in the last couple of years is I've been teaching doctors, and we kind of call it, it's kind of like a rehab course where right. we take them and we reteach them their biochemistry, and we reteach them their hormones, and we reteach them their physiology from this perspective of thinking about the interactions rather than thinking in a linear fashion.
And
depression is not a Prozac deficiency.
That's great. I have an aunt who is a nurse teacher. She teaches people how to take care of children in a nurse practitioner space. Very sick children, unfortunately. Though she's optimistic and wonderful. I had some time with her over the holidays. And one of the things that I was sobered by as well was that a lot of the nursing students that were coming through were doing it because it looked like a good job. And, you know, of course, in some ways, you know, you can do well in medicine financially if you're looking at it as that the purpose. At the same time, if you have a large body of employees that are doing something because it's their job, and you say to them, hey, you know that school you went through? Here's another level of school you should go through so you're better at your job. And they look down, they go, well, I'm getting paid. Like, there is a kind mm-hmm. of sad state in that. You know, you are an exceptional doctor in the way that you continually learned and taught your entire career, and you haven't slowed down. And I say exceptional not just because I think of you as an exceptional person, but because you are an exception in the medical field. Not all doctors do that. So what you're asking at some level is, hey, all that schooling that you still haven't paid for, and that's why you're so stressed out about your income, you really need to look at this a completely different way and relearn. How much uptake is there in the medical space to do that? How many people go, good idea?
Well, I can't give you really good numbers because I don't have either a really accurate numerator or an accurate denominator.
Sure.
But there is a huge cohort of people who went into medicine because they were passionate about the wanting to help people and fascinated with the intellectual scientific aspects of it. And it's a great combination because the pay is decent and you have a good sense of making a contribution. I mean, a person who's doing research, if you're wanting to do science, if you do research, I mean, you may beat your head against the wall for your entire career and never have a breakthrough discovery and make a contribution, but you don't really get the contribution coming up and shaking your hand and saying, thank you, you changed my life, which is a wonderful experience that I've had the pleasure of having, you know, more times than I can actually count. And that's huge for me.
So you would say a lot of your colleagues are motivated by that?
A lot of my colleagues are motivated by that. And when you tell a doctor that they can be more effective, particularly if they've gotten to the point where they really have hit the wall on pharmacotherapeutics, which it all seems so magical the first decade, and then you start having the bad outcomes and you start seeing the limitations of this, and you realize that you can statistically really only deal with about 3 drug interactions. Mm-hmm. After that, it mathematically becomes impossible to predict who you're going to kill with a combination of agents or who you're going to mess up badly.
Right.
And so when you're in a paradigm where you see people who are on, you know, 5-10 drugs, and you know
that's not
that
really going to work,
bad, and everything you do for that person seems to make something else sick, and you have no idea where to go.
And you start looking for functional medicine in some ways, right? It's kind of an outcome of being a responsible
and some
physician.
People go into functional medicine because they really want to get off the hamster wheel and do good medicine again, actually spend time with their patients. And the nice thing about functional medicine is that these chronic diseases go away, that don't have to see the same patient with the same problem year in and year out, because they actually get better. And that is so rewarding. The first couple of diabetics that I reversed, it was like, oh, they taught me I couldn't do this. They told me this is an irreversible disease, and when this drug stops working, then you add this A, B, or C drug, and then when B stops working, well, then you can add A or C, and then when all A, B, and C are no longer working, then you add insulin, and that's how I was taught to manage diabetes. And you see the premise: when that stops working, then add this.
Do this next thing,
But you can blow that premise out of the water by saying, okay, what inputs do I need to change in that individual so that the drug is no longer necessary? And because of epigenetics, because of the triggering factors that often occur in diabetics, if you can get someone early before they've really settled into that new kind of groove as a diabetic, it's very reversible. And they go to being someone who has to be careful about how much sugar and starch they eat.
And that's it. And no medication.
And no medication.
And as long as they do that, they're good.
Yeah. And it's pretty amazing.
So it sounds optimistic in the sense that there are a lot of doctors that are going, this is the time to start looking at this more.
So we have a functional medicine clinic at the Cleveland Clinic. And this is the first thing in the time in the country. This is the, you know, center, the mecca of mainstream medicine. Or one
Cleveland
of the meccas.
Clinic. Okay.
Yeah, this is the big time. And they set it up as initially an employee clinic. So for their employees who have chronic diseases, they're going to say, oh, let's see if we can improve their health. And it's been so successful because they've got some skin in the game, right? They have to pay for the health care for those people.
Sure.
And it goes to their...
I'm laughing at that because it seems so comical that that's the way that this very traditional medicine system, the hospital functioned, where the administrators went, you know, we have a problem with some of our employees. Let's try to solve that problem. And it was completely a money thing. And of course, none of the doctors were like, whatever. And they actually resolve success.
Right.
That's fantastic.
But that's, you have to show that it saves money. If you can show that it saves the system money, which is what we're doing right now, and you could publish that, then suddenly everybody's really interested in it. And at that point, it's rewarded rather than punished.
Right.
Right now it's punished. It's financial cost. It's a time cost. There's personal rewards that come from it. And people will actually sacrifice in order to do it. And I have a lot of respect for all of the doctors who show up at these classes that I teach, because they are making a huge sacrifice, and I want to honor that, and I want to send them home with things that they can use that will improve their patients' lives right away so they can start getting those rewards reinforcements.
Let's conclude this joint episode thing with some, I know there's not universals in this situation, because of course everything we've been talking about is that kind of the outliers are really the people that are helped in some ways in this. But are there some general suggestions you have on diet that kind of are universal success in our current society? And I'm assuming one of those would be like, don't drink soda, like the sugar water, not so good.
Right.
Like, do you have some general suggestions?
Yeah, well, some general precepts would be good. Okay, so the first one is tried only to consume molecules that existed on the planet while humans were evolving. So avoid new-to-nature molecules, because those are harder for your body to break down and have unintended consequences. So that means organic food wherever possible, you know, eating the clean 15 if you're going to go non-organic, the so-called environmental working group Dirty Dozen.
What are those?
Well, basically a simple concept is if it can have pesticide residue, try to eat it organic. So some foods, there's a lot of pesticide used on them, like apples, and we know the pesticide is a carcinogen, so we really shouldn't be eating the apples that have that pesticide, so you should buy organic apples.
Okay. What's an example of a fruit that you could buy that doesn't get pesticides normally in commercial use? Are there examples?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're kind of catching me up short, so let me think. Okay. Oranges are good because they have a thick peel, and most of the pesticide ends up in the peel.
Okay. So you don't necessarily need to get organic oranges.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. I see the separation.
And so the idea is... certain things, really, you want to get organic celery. They use a lot of pesticides because celery is really tasty to caterpillars. So you want to get organic celery. But avocados, it really doesn't matter whether you get organic avocados. So in general, if you're going to skin it, that's better for the conventional. And there are a few exceptions where you really want to go organic, but that's where you go to the list. And so just EWG.org, the Environmental Working Group's website, and search Clean 15 or Dirty Dozen, and
you'll get it.
They'll pop up.
Okay.
So that's one. You want to go for high fiber, which are foods that haven't been heavily processed, so that there's a lot of residual carbohydrate that's undigestible for you, but is necessary for a healthy microbiome.
Example of this?
Well, for example, fruits and vegetables have fiber. If you take an orange and you eat that orange, you're getting a lot of fiber. You're getting pectin.
When you say fiber, like what I imagine is like a flour that's been ground down. But when you're saying fiber, you're meaning like fibrous material. Like in the orange, there's all those things you can actually see. They're not the juice, but the pulp and the other things. And that's a larger structure. Fibrous, that when it goes through your system, your body might be able to digest some of it, but a lot of it's just going to pass through your system.
Well, actually, there are many, many molecules which are water soluble, so they read as a goo or a gel when you consume them. The goo on the inside of the little segment of the orange in each of the little walled things that makes up the orange. I don't know. They look like muscle fascicles. I don't know what the technical term for it is. But the goo in there, inside that, is a lot of it's undigestible by your enzyme systems, and it's there to feed. And the bacteria are in your gut because you eat that stuff, and the bacteria love that stuff, and that's their food. So if you consume plant fibers and lots of them, you feed the gut flora, and the gut flora are important for making certain vitamins like vitamin K. They're important for transforming a lot of the toxins that come in for food and actually detoxifying them for you.
Mm. So what you're saying is that there's some stuff that gets in your body that stuff is the thing that helps transform it so it can leave your body, your biome.
Yeah. Okay. No, your microbiome is hugely important. It also sends a ton of signals to your immune system and is a regulatory, has a huge regulatory functioning
in
our bodies.
It's so cool that we like that we're not just a human, that we're actually this other thing.
Yeah, we're commensals. We're rainforest. We actually are in ecology. Mm-hmm. We're in ecology with a brain, and that's our
flaw.
Well, we're just finally recognizing that. So to recap, you want to eat lots of fruits and vegetables. You want to eat them in a form where the pulp is still present. If you juice them, and that's all you do is vegetable juice, then you're going to be lacking in fiber. So
now you're just taking that sugar in and not the fiber in, and you're not getting the benefits.
So fruit juice in particular, I discourage. With respect to vegetable juices, if you are trying to detox, you need extra flavonoids from the plants. If I've got somebody who's got cancer, we know that if you can get certain flavonoids at very high levels, it tends to turn off the cancer genes all by itself.
But this is in a situation where you probably want assistance. You want somebody that's actually inspecting.
But in terms of general principles, you want to try to stay organic where you can. You want to eat lots of plants. You want to. It's fine to eat fat. It's saturated fat that is like omega-6 healthy fat, like coconut oil, is probably fine. Butter is probably just fine. Of course, if all you eat is butter, you're going to run into problems. But we are adapted to consume fat, and it's highly desirable food biologically because it's nutritionally dense. And so you don't really have to be worried about the non-animal fats. And if you're going to be eating beef or pork, remember that in evolution, those were game animals. They were lean. And it's the feedlot, because we have an economic system that pays by the pound.
Right.
So that animal's worth more if it's got fat. And that was not how we evolved. That's not what we evolved to eat.
Right. We were eating ones that were running from us.
Yes. We were eating ones we had to chase. And so they were lean, and they got older, they got sick, or they tripped over a rock, and that's how come we got them. But that's an unnatural component. That sort of heavily marbled meat is just not a food
in the sense
that you should eat.
As we were actually evolving, we didn't have livestock, so there was no cow at that point. We hadn't domesticated or whatever it's called when you transform the cow into what it is now.
Right. And milk is really not a good food. So milk-based foods, for a number of reasons, one of them is the growth factors, and the other of which is that we as adults really very evidently are not good at processing milk. That's why so many people have lactose intolerance.
Right. But cheese is so good, Dawn.
Yes, and I limit it. I eat cheese too. Uh-huh. I don't eat cheese every day. So that's a good rule. Don't eat cheese every day.
Right.
Don't have dairy every day.
Because, of course, your system, if it's doing relatively well, can compensate for these anomalies at some level. So you mentioned plants, but you didn't mention like this big, what seems to be a big change in society about gluten and breads, which are processed plants at a different level. Are you kind of thinking no on those or yes on those, or is it totally dependent on the person?
Okay, let's start with the term whole grains. Okay, a whole grain means whole as in it hasn't been ground up into flour. So if you want to eat whole grains, if you want to have wheat berries or kashi or something, or make couscous, or steel-cut oatmeal.
Got it.
As long as you're not diabetic, steel-cut oatmeal is fine. But what you're looking for there is you need the outside of the grain, and you also want it to be intact so that it doesn't hit your system with a whole bunch of glucose at once. Mm-hmm. If you grind it up, you've altered it. That's a industrial shift. And by grinding it up, you make it more bioavailable and you get more energy out of it. But that we are in a situation where you're all energy toxic in our culture. So
we get too much energy.
We get too much energy and we don't burn it. Right. And we've engineered activity out of our culture. I just spent 12 days actually in Paris, but two of the days were traveling. So call it 10 days in Paris. They have not engineered movement out of their culture.
Right.
By the time you climb down those steps to the metro and climb back up out and
walk
around.
That's true in a lot of large cities, wouldn't you say?
No.
No?
No. I wouldn't say. I think it's
most
more true.
I time in Paris, so I definitely feel that way.
I think it's more true in Europe.
You see the population as a thinner population, seeming more mobile population.
Yeah. And just even the phenotypic changes in my husband over the course of 10 days eating French food. He's a computer guy. He sits a lot. He moved a lot.
Yeah, he said he lost like 4 pounds tonight when I came in. Explain that.
No, he lost more than that. He gained some of it back. But he did. He lost a lot of weight. He lost like a pound a day.
Just because he's moving more.
Just because he's moving more. And we need to re-engineer that back into our culture. And I don't know whether it's going to be little VR rooms where we're hooked up to, you know, very sophisticated devices so that we're waltzing with the stars. I don't know what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
But VR could be very useful because you've got to make it interesting. And we seem to be crowding into cities, which I'm not quite sure where that's going.
Yeah.
But movement is E. Movement is energy burning, and we need to move more. But we were talking about food.
Yeah.
So fiber, lots of fruits and vegetables, stay away from ground up grains. And sugar is a foreign compound. It's not natural to our diet. We aren't adapted for it. We were supposed to use our insulin. We were supposed to boot our insulin levels during the summer when the fruit ripened. And then the rest of the year...
Not have it or not have much of it. Right, maybe you'd find some honey or something.
And now it is daily and we are not built for that biologically.
So, yeah, totally. And we also have a system where we are built to find that sugar. Right, so we have that feedback system going, oh, I want more of that.
Yeah, it's
hardwired.
That's
completely about not having enough of it.
Now, going back to the gluten, though,
yeah.
Let's just take a moment on gluten. Normal wheat doesn't have a high gluten content.
Where does the gluten come from?
Well, it's present, but it's present at fairly small amounts. So this is a case of where there's a quality that gluten gives to grain that's a chewiness. Yeah. And that chewiness is something that was, desirable to the consumer. So it became economically beneficial to have that kind of chewy quality to your bread. So the breeding starts to make a high gluten wheat.
Just like the cow didn't exist in the situation prior to us, the wheat didn't exist the way it does.
And there are certain individuals who have a particular set of DNA. And these are cell surface markers, recognition factors for the immune system that we use in organ matching. If you happen to have these cell surface markers and you're exposed to a lot of gluten, maybe you take a bunch of ibuprofen for a sprained ankle and you're eating, you know, crackers and toast and hamburger buns and your normal diet, but now your gut is a little raw from all that ibuprofen. So your immune system is in there anyway, defending that part of the gut against bacteria to keep, because it's now raw, so it isn't doing its barrier functioning. And now all this gluten comes along, and now suddenly the immune system says, wait, I'm fighting these bacteria. I wonder if that's a bacteria. And so it starts making antibodies against gluten.
You're speaking about celiac disease.
That's where we're going.
Okay.
So now you're making antibodies against gluten. Oops, wait, DRQ and DR8, these recognition factors, look like gluten. So now we're going to make antibodies against these tissue recognition factors that are present on our own surfaces.
Wait. So the marker that looks like that matches to break down the gluten that your antibodies are making then has the same marker to part of your tissue.
Yeah.
And so that starts to break down your tissue.
Mistaken identity. The immune system starts attacking.
And that's why it's an autoimmune disease.
That's why it's an autoimmune disease.
But this isn't with everybody with gluten.
No, but gluten is kind of an irritant. So it can cause local inflammation, and that can lead to, it can lead to the same problem, a breakdown in the barrier functioning, which then people start to have antibodies against. So if you have antibodies against something you're eating, you're not going to feel great when you eat it because it's going to create inflammatory reactions.
So it's just like when people, I remember as a child at some point in my age, I started, anytime I had eggs, diarrhea, right? And so I just stopped eating eggs. And at one point, I actually switched away my diet and stopped eating any breads, I think, at all. In fact, changed my diet quite a bit. And now I eat eggs, no problem. So it's like there was, who knows what was going on there, but there definitely was a causal relationship with my diet changing what I could or could not eat.
Right. And these are real things. And there's now actual scientific evidence for non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is big because it's now a recognized thing, and eventually we'll have an ICD-10 code, which will mean that you can get paid for treating it through insurance, maybe.
So right now you can't get people can't get treated for it?
Well, let's not even get into that one. That's such can of worms.
And it's not a fun can of worms.
No, it's not. It's too depressing. I think this has been a really exciting,
it's been great.
Gee whiz, Mr. Science walk through physiology. Hopefully everyone has enjoyed the wander.
I hope so. Thank you very much, Don.
You're very welcome.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. It's used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geeks said hi. I want to thank Dr. Don for joining me today. It was a real pleasure.